Hello, this is a Science Set Free podcast with myself, Mark Vernon, and Rupert Sheldrake. Hi, Rupert.
Hello, Mark.
Rupert, I fairly recently got back from India, my first trip to India, and it really focused for me the business of what it is to be Christian, you know, certainly from a Christian culture, and encountering the full-on religiosity of other cultures, and particularly in India, Hinduism, and quite a lot of Islam as well. And I found myself, you know, really responding to it and taking part in ceremonies and pujas, hearing some Qawwali singing in a Muslim shrine, that kind of thing. But returned me to this old question about pluralism and how religions relate, how, you know, I as a Christian, what I can make of, you know, the Hindu gods, which in, you know, in many respects do come from a different cosmology, a different sense of things. And I know that this is something you've engaged with over a long period of time. You know, can you be a Buddha-Christian or a Christo-Vedantic or something like that? Feels very contemporary question as well. So I wanted to, you know, explore some of that with you. How these things come together. I mean, you, in our conversations, you talk very comfortably as an Anglican, and yet you have all this background and, you know, I think still a lot of current strands from other traditions as well that are alive in your own spirituality.
Very much so. You know, I lived in India for 7 years, and when I went there, I wasn't a Christian. I was still, I was a kind of meditating atheist, but with a great interest in Hindu philosophy. So for the first couple of years I was in India, I was visiting a lot of temples, going to ashrams, hearing discourses by Hindu holy men. And then I had I was friendly with a Muslim family in Hyderabad where I lived, and the grandfather of the family was a Sufi teacher, and so he and I became very friendly, and he gave me a wazifa, and I did a Sufi kind of meditation. I used to go to Sufi shrines in Qawwali, and I learned Urdu, which is the Muslim language in Hyderabad. I had a Muslim driver, and I had to spend at least an hour a day with him in the car because I had to get to the farm where I worked. And when I went travelling around villages, we travelled together, and we spoke Urdu. He taught me Urdu, and he was a devout Muslim. When we were crossing the Himalayas once into the Lahul Valley, we were at 14,000 feet on a pass in the snow, and he said, "Sahib, it is time for the midday prayers. Is it all right if we stop here?" So yes. And so he gets out his compass, finds where Mecca is, rolls out his prayer mat on the snow, and there with mountains all around, he's doing his prayers. So I was very much immersed in this world. And then I also knew Parsis and Sikhs and Jains, so as well as Indian Christians. So India is a place where you can't avoid religious pluralism. I mean, it's everywhere. It's the whole basis of Indian culture, really. And Hinduism itself is an aggregate of all sorts of different approaches and subcults and sects and, well, not really sects, because they recognize each other. They don't cut themselves off from each other. So it's a great place to think about it. And I also then lived for 2 years in the ashram of Father Bede Griffiths, which is a Indian ashram where you sit on the floor, you take off your shoes, and it looks, the chapel looks like a Hindu temple. The services began with the Gayatri Mantra, which is a Sanskrit mantra, asking the blessings of the light of the sun to bless our meditation. And I once said to Father Bede, who was an English Benedictine monk, who'd lived there for years and wore the orange robes of a Indian holy man, I said, "How can you have the Gayatri Mantra in a Catholic ashram?" And he said, "Precisely because it's Catholic. Catholic means universal, it includes everything. And if it excludes paths to God, it's not Catholic, it's just a sect." So he had a very broad approach, a very inclusive approach. And his ashram were actually embodied this inclusive approach, which has had a big influence on me. I mean, I see all these various religious paths as different ways to God or different ways to the ultimate reality. And Father Bede often compared them to fingers of a hand. You've got the four fingers and a thumb. They all come from the palm of the hand. And he used to say the palm of the hand is that sort of basic mystical experience of connection and unity that's beyond words, beyond form, beyond culture, that's at the heart of every religious tradition. And then when you work out from that, it's put into language, into cultural forms, and takes on historical aspects, etc. It's like the fingers, that they're separate, but they come from a common source. That made a lot of sense to me, and it still does.
Yeah, I mean, broadly that makes sense to me as well. And I suppose that, as it were, the rubber hits the ground a bit when you come to, say, texts in Christianity, like Jesus in John's Gospel purportedly saying, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except by me." Or, of course, in Christianity, this great emphasis on conversion and evangelization, you know, go and make disciples of all nations, but baptizing in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. And I feel I want to read those inclusively rather than exclusively. And I would say something like, you know, Jesus was a particular, and it's in the particular that his uniqueness lies, a particular incarnation of a Catholic universal principle that in the Western tradition is called the Logos, the kind of creative impulse that runs through all things. So in a way, those statements aren't statements of exclusivity, but they're sort of surfacing profound Catholic truths, you might say, that for we human beings, the Logos, the divine principle in creation, in our material nature, is the way to God. I'm seeing it like that. But there's still, I think there's still a sort of rub. You know, in Hinduism, when I was in India, it's very natural to think, you know, one person has a devotion to Krishna, another to Rama, you know, another to the goddess. And these are people's different paths, maybe in this life as opposed to another life. You know, they're working out something through particular devotion to particular gods. Whereas Christianity does have a more monodimensional feel, to me anyway, on the whole. As it were, you know, when you don't go to temple and perform your private devotions, you sit in a congregation and all look in the same direction. And there's something quite symbolic about that as well. So I felt this kind of tension there, nonetheless, even though, broadly speaking, I would have a plural view.
Yes. Well, I think there is a tension. And, you know, the way of the truth and life thing, Father Bede's understanding of that was very similar to yours. And, you know, if it's just Jesus of Nazareth, you know, a Jewish man in a particular place and time with a particular religion that grew up through his disciples and after him, then it's a very exclusive claim. But as it's a central claim in Christianity that Jesus of Nazareth was also Logos, the Son of God, in the most general sense, you know, through him were all things made, as it says in the Creed. Well, all things were certainly not made through a particular man, Jesus of Nazareth, because everything had already been made in terms of the universe by the time he appeared. You know, the vast majority of species of plants and animals, etc., were already there. So it can't possibly mean just Jesus of Nazareth. So it has to be taken in this more inclusive way. But nevertheless, there is a sense in which Christianity, like Judaism and Islam, which are part of the same family, tend to have a more exclusive feel. You know, this is the way. Whereas Hinduism, by its very nature, has this very broad approach. And Father Bede used to he was very amused by the fact that when Christian missionaries went to India, they'd tell people they were trying to convert all about Jesus, and they'd say, "Yes, very good," and ethical teachings, "Yes, yes, very good. He's the Son of God." "Yes, yes, very good. Son of God," you know, like Vishnu and Krishna and so on. "Avatars, sons of God," and Buddha, you know. So they have all this idea of all these sons of God. So then the missionaries found that they accept virtually everything they said about Jesus. When they said, "Oh, but he's the only one, and you can't have any of the others," why? What is the problem? You know, they couldn't get that. And rightly so, I think, unless you can produce a really, really good argument as to why these are not other paths, are not valid paths to God, then I think they had a strong point.
So another way of putting that would be, are the differences, for all the, you know, the commonalities, you know, are there real differences? And here's a possibility that I've been thinking about. Rather than seeing Christianity as saying being unique on its own, a cut above all the rest, maybe it's had a distinctive role in the development of religions across, you know, recent centuries. So I do wonder whether Christianity, with its emphasis on the particular and the individual incarnation, rather than, as it were, incarnation springing up routinely everywhere, whether that had a kind of galvanizing effect in the development of the individual as we now think of it in the modern world, the individual person. You know, so after Christianity, things like free will start to become very important. Conscience, personal conscience, is a bit there in ancient Greek ideas, but it really seems to take hold after the Christian sort of developments in the first century AD. And I wonder whether maybe by some actual process of osmosis, or maybe it was more culturally things developing elsewhere, that has led to a kind of inflection on the individual that, for example, you might find in Hindu texts. So I've read about the Bhagavad Gita a little bit, which is just a bit post-Christian, probably 2nd or 3rd century, I think, AD. And it's not saying that it's a directly Christian-influenced text, but the idea that sacrifice in the Bhagavad Gita becomes, rather than something that's performed in the temple, becomes something that you as the individual perform in your inner life all day, every day, offering what you're doing, even what you're breathing, to Krishna. You know, I wonder whether that could only have happened, as it were, at that particular time, which presumably is the case, and maybe that Christianity has had some sort of indirect influence on how Hinduism understood itself. And then conversely, maybe Hinduism now has got something to tell Christianity that... for example, you know, sacrifice is something that we all do. It's not something that Jesus did once for us 2,000 years ago. You know, just that sort of interplay. So there's distinctiveness, but with an interplay that can highlight strengths, you might say, in one tradition, and things that might have got even got a bit lost in other traditions.
Oh, I think so, definitely. I mean, I think I see each religion as having its own strengths, and it's a matter of emphasis. I mean, The Hindu tradition, which has not only temple worship, but also holy men who wandering sadhus and people who live in caves and meditate in forests and in the Himalayas and so on, that whole tradition is more like the monasticism of Christianity, where you'd have parish churches with people doing their normal lives and getting married and all that kind of thing in the church. But you also had, and still have in Catholic and Orthodox countries, people who are, as it were, spiritual specialists living in monasteries, communities, or as hermits. Now, Hinduism has that too. It has the temple priests, the Brahmins. People don't expect the temple priests or Brahmins to be necessarily to be great spiritual teachers or to be deep meditators. They expect them to do their job as temple priests, know the right chants, know what the right rituals, how to do the pujas. They're basically functionaries of the temple. So they have this very strong meditative tradition from the sadhu side of it. They also have a very strong pilgrimage tradition through the idea that the whole of India is sacralized. And when I was living there, one of the things I was most impressed by was this everyday Hinduism, where people have holy trees in each village and sacred animals and all these pilgrimages, both large and small, that the land is sacralized, the animals and nature is sacralized, rather than seen as purely functional and religion separate from it. So I think we have a lot to learn from that, and as we have a lot to learn from shamanic traditions as well about nature and connection with nature. And I think Hindus have learned, I don't know about the individualism thing, but one of the things that 19th century Christianity had a big influence on in India was the fact that missionaries used to go out there and look after the poor and the sick and have hospitals and run schools. But Hindus, on the whole, didn't do those kinds of things very much. And the Ramakrishna mission was a response of Hinduism to start doing that kind of thing, running schools, having kind of missionary type activities, helping others, and wasn't so much part of their emphasis, whereas this service to others is a very strong part of Christianity. So I think they're complementary and different emphasis in one or the other. But I think following a particular path is helpful nevertheless. I once went to talk to a Hindu guru about exactly this point, and he said the trouble with Westerners who come to India is, he said, they get excited by something, they sort of like dig a little hole looking for the water, and then they get suddenly dig another little hole. He said, but if you want to have a well, you have to dig a long way in one place. So he was sort of an argument against kind of eclecticism, or just sort of being like a butterfly flitting from one to the other, and the need to follow a particular path enough to, really to get to the point of it and get the connection through it.
Yeah, I think that is the more sustained benefit I feel I've gained from engaging with other religious texts, particularly that it's highlighted something that I think I would have otherwise found quite difficult to find in Anglican Christianity, but it's enabled me to focus on something and then go and find it in the Christian tradition, which it just feels a bit more at home, a bit more familiar to me. So I can grow into it more in that context, but having sort of been prompted by other engagements. So, for example, I think another thing about modern Christianity is it can often be presented as basically a salvation religion, that Christ has done something that saves you from something that would otherwise have been your fate. I guess it's a post-Reformation take on Christianity particularly. But I find very unhelpful because it feels to me you rather passive as a Christian, as if, your main task is to kind of accept Jesus and what Jesus has done. Again, in Indian traditions, I found a much greater emphasis on the transformation of your own consciousness, so that your perception of things dramatically changes. And that's very much what spiritual practices and other things offer you.
Mm.
Now, I think this is there in the Christian tradition too. In John's Gospel, for example, Jesus reportedly does say, on that day you'll know that you're in me as much as I'm in the Father, as it were, and maybe you'll know even greater things than I'm able to say now. So there is a sort of dramatic sense of awareness and perception of God and the cosmos in John's Gospel, but it's sort of got a bit lost in everyday, more sort of on the street kind of Christianity. People tend not to think about it in that way. So I've gone digging back through the mystical traditions and reading people like Meister Eckhart and so on, So it's all sort of there, full on, actually. But it's been helpful for me to be prompted to look for it.
Oh, yes.
And to get a focus.
Exactly. I felt, with all the other religions I've encountered, in Islam, for example, there's a tremendous sense that Muslims have of the moment-by-moment sustaining of everything by God, and the utter dependence of us all on God from moment to moment, which is why they say Inshallah so much. When I was flying on Pakistan Airlines, and about the announcement came through the intercom, it said, in 5 minutes' time, Inshallah, we will land in Lahore. They don't say that on British Airways. We will land at Heathrow in 5 minutes. And when one morning when I was driving to work, my driver asked me how I was, and I felt, I feel a bit miserable today, and I've got a cold and that sort of thing. He said, but God is great. He said, you have the blessing of life. And so he immediately... So the idea that from moment to moment we're blessed by God and that we have to live in God's presence from moment to moment is very much a living reality for Muslims, much more so than for many Christians. And it's this moment-by-moment presence of God in one's life that they're very aware of. And I found that tremendously helpful.
Yeah, another thing I've got from Islam, particularly the Sufi traditions, is the role that bewilderment plays in the spiritual path. It's quite common in Sufi mystics to read of how they devoted their life and they'd studied the Quran and they performed the things that their religion required, and they were devout and so on. And then suddenly they fall in love with a Christian woman or something like that, you know. And it seems that their whole world has been turned upside down, and their disciples are saying, you know, what on earth are you doing? You're supposed to be a devout Muslim. And there's a sense of sort of radical bewilderment and sort of loss that is part and parcel of approaching the divine, which ultimately, you know, is beyond your grasp and possession and so on. Otherwise, it's not God at all. And again, in Christianity, that feels to me to be quite a hard spiritual step to find. So there are ecstatic traditions in Christianity, and Pentecostalism would be the obvious case in point. And although they have a strangely conservative inflection, they feel like they're trying to recover something that is imagined in the early church, speaking in tongues and so on. So they, although they're ecstatic, they feel like they have a slightly claustrophobic feel to them at the same time, rather than, as it were, opening up through things which might well be regarded as kind of heresies, but within this all-encompassing view of God. Heresies must be, what looks like heresy to you must be in there somewhere as well, you might say. So that's another thing which, say, I found in Sufism, anyway, this idea of bewilderment and, losing. It's a funny thing, because it's not just not knowing nothing. It's having felt you've maybe engaged quite a long way, and then suddenly finding that all you had hasn't really begun to get to grips with it at all. It's that kind of sense I've got from that bit of Islam, anyway.
I think we're exceptionally lucky in the modern world that we do have access to all these different traditions, which is a new situation. My wife, Jill Purse, has had a Tibetan Buddhist teacher for many years, so our house is full of Tibetan mandalas, and she does various forms of Tibetan chanting. And there, I've been with her on some of these Tibetan retreats. And again, here's a tradition which has a huge amount to tell us about the nature of the mind and practices that deal with the mind, and things which other religions really don't touch on much. For example, the dream yoga, where they actually practice, cultivate lucid dreaming. Well, people spontaneously have lucid dreams in the West and so on, but here's a serious religious path where there's a serious part of it is the cultivation of lucid dreams, because it's telling you a lot about the nature of the mind and your ability to control what's happening in your mind as a practice for what happens when you die. And again, this is something that they have that much more than other people. On the other hand, they're very weak when it comes to cosmology. That's not their focus. They're not that interested in nature. They're more interested in the mind. So again, there's a strong emphasis in one area. You can find sort of ecological aspects of it, but they're much less emphasized.
I like the idea of having things in your house that you live with. So in our house, we particularly bought a couple of images of Ganesh when we were in India, because this was a god I knew was all over the place in Hindu homes and Hindu temples. And, it's over virtually every doorway. I mean, you go into a house, an image of Ganesh. And yet I found the elephant god quite hard to know how to relate to, because again, it feels so unlike anything you find in Christianity. I know there's a sort of backstory about a son dying and being brought to life, which vaguely has a few Christian overtones, but the symbol itself, feels very, very different. So anyway, so we bought a couple of these figures, and we're going to live with them. We put one by our front door, and we've got one sort of by the central point in our house, and see whether, almost I can, relate to the symbol, knowing a little bit about it. I know it's about welcome and about blessing, and it's about liminal spaces, and Ganesh sort of overseeing that. And it, approaching it in that way does change things, I think. I kind of, if nothing else, it's made me think about, what's going on when I step into a house, because you're not just stepping into a different physical space, you're stepping into a different psychic space, you might say.
Yes.
And the idea that a presence can overlook that and can, remind you and guide you somehow into that. I think I would never have thought of it that way unless we bought the image back and had it there when we walk into the house.
Yes, I mean, I think we can learn all these different things. And actually, even within a given religion like Christianity, there's many different branches of it with different emphases. Like the Baptists have a strong emphasis on the rite of passage in adolescence, death and rebirth. And as you know, I think they may well originally have held people under long enough to introduce, have a near-death experience through drowning. And that's a rite of passage which other churches don't have. And the Baptists, like the experts on this death and rebirth experience, seeing the light, this conversion experience. But they're not very good on some of the other aspects. And Greek Orthodox are wonderful on the sort of liturgy and mysterious chanting that goes on for hours. And with their apophatic theology, the negative theology that says, emphasizes that we don't know what God is. We can only say what God is not, what God is. It's a deeply mystical theology, much less rationalistic than the Western tradition. So I think all through the different Christian churches, the Pentecostals who speak in tongues, and that's their particular charisma, that's their particular gift or path. And Methodists who have the idea you've got to sort of practice what you preach and be serious about making this not just sort of high-flown, fine-sounding stuff, but make it real in everyday life. I mean, a very strong emphasis on that. All these different traditions, even within Christianity, have different emphases, and each has their own strength, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right within Christianity, and then also extending it to looking at other traditions as well, which, again, you can, in modern cosmopolitan places, you know, like England and so on, you can quite easily get strong access to, too. You can either go to a study group looking at a text or go to a temple where this is a lived thing and do so and think, you know, what might have this that can enliven something within my own context. Can be a really good way of, you know, in a quite strongly secular culture like ours, it's hard to find sometimes the sort of conscious space where these things can be allowed to run, as you're kind of saying you found in India so much, where pluralism and the meeting of the spiritual and the material world is, you know, right alongside each other.
Well, the other path that I think we really needs to be integrated in where it hasn't been, and this is something I've been thinking about recently, is science, because science has a practice. It involves very close attention to the details of nature. You know, if you're doing experiments on plant cells and you're looking at them under a microscope and you're affecting them by various heat treatments or chemicals or whatever, you're studying in great detail the activity of nature or of molecules inside the cells. Or, in the case of astronomy, through radio telescopes, galaxies far beyond our own, things that nobody ever knew about before. These are telling us something about the entire natural world that no religion has ever included, because they were beyond the scope of unaided human senses. Somehow none of that has yet been integrated with these great spiritual traditions. It is, I think, a path of its own, the path of natural science, the detailed study of nature. It involves, I mean, people who do it often dedicate their lives to it. Some scientists are kind of workaholics. They spend, you know, work long hours every day in pursuit of discovering these details. It's rather ascetic. Very few people are in it for the money. It's almost like a kind of monastic world you enter in laboratories. And yet, because it's been traditionally cut off from the realm of religion and spirituality, it has a kind of arid feel to it. You don't feel a kind of great joy in this. It's more, the day-to-day life is more like competitive, getting the results before somebody else does. It's not a very enlightened culture. And so I think that something that hasn't yet been done is kind of extending it, seeing science as a spiritual path and enabling scientists themselves to feel that this is a kind of spiritual path and can be ultimately integrated with other spiritual paths.
Yeah, I had a little taste of that, I think, when I did a physics degree. So I did a physics degree as an undergraduate, and one of my projects was to measure the heights of mountains on the moon, and because I got very interested in the astrophysics side particularly, and I don't remember much of what we actually did, but I do remember the experience of doing it, that we had to get up at sort of 3 o'clock in the morning and go up to the science site and then clamber up to where the telescope was. And we did it in the winter because the air is cooler and stiller, so we get better photos. That was a key sort of part of the project. And I do remember thinking I felt more like a sort of monk rising when the world was asleep to go and investigate another world as much as anything else, you know. And so that sense of it did feel like it was a spiritual experience as much as the practical business of getting decent enough pictures of these shadows on the moon to be able to measure them.
I think it'd be really transformative for the whole profession of science for people to recover the sense that it is a path. It is a kind of path, a sort of spiritual path.
And I think there's also a kind of initiation that, in a way, I feel I didn't quite get through. That I did a physics degree, and I sort of learnt enough, as it were, to pass the exams. But I felt I, for example, didn't become fluent enough with the language of maths in order to really go on the path much further. So there was a sense of, I mean, that was something that I didn't quite get. But I can understand how to really be a physicist, opposed to studying physics, you do have to go through a kind of initiation. And it is a shift of consciousness. It is to have a different sense of the world that then, as you're saying, you can really focus and develop in that way as well. Yeah, well, I hadn't thought about science in terms of our pluralism at all.
Well, exactly. Well, it's obviously a huge and rich field. And I don't think we've got time to cover any more attempts at integration, or at least to see the ingredients of the integration. But I do think this is one of the great challenges of the 21st century, because never before have all these different paths come together. And they all coexist in London. You don't even have to travel abroad to find these different paths anymore. So I think it's something that we've only really begun to scratch the surface of.
Yeah, well, I think you must be right. So thanks very much.
Thank you.